I'm Leslie Weidenbender. Today on No Limits, we're talking about organ donation, the people who need transplants, and the people who are willing to donate their organs. Nationwide, more than 110,000 people, including more than 1,500 Hoosiers, are waiting for life-saving organ transplants. Most of them are waiting for kidneys, and many will never receive the transplants they need. Today, we'll talk about the issues with Sam Davis, Director of Professional Services and Public Affairs for the Indiana Organ Procurement Organization, and Jerry Wild, an Indiana University East professor who received a new kidney. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, or connect via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I'm Leslie Weidenbender, managing editor of the StateHouseFile.com, a news website powered by Franklin College journalism students, and I'm sitting in today for John Kroll. Today, we're going to talk about organ donation, and in the studio, we have Sam Davis, Director of Public Affairs for the Indiana Organ Procurement Organization. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
On the phone, we have Jerry Wild, a professor at Indiana University East, who received a kidney transplant after one of his students helped him find a donor on Facebook. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You can call us at 866-476-3881 to participate in the show. You can also email nolimits@wfyi.org or connect via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Jerry, I wanted to get to your story right away. Tell us about how you came to need an organ transplant and how you ended up getting one.
It's kind of a remarkable story. I actually had a kidney disease back in the early 90s, and I was lucky enough to receive a transplant back in 1992, and everything was going absolutely perfectly fine. I had a normal life for 17 years, and then it was discovered that I had a cancerous growth on my transplanted kidney, and by the time they discovered this, it was so large and it had invaded the kidney that the only way to remove the cancer was remove the kidney. So I had to go back on dialysis, and I was very much hoping to have another chance at another transplant. And then things took a dramatic turn, and a former student of mine, somebody named Leah Hostelet, set up a Facebook page called Find a Kidney for Jerry. And literally the day that the page went live, a local woman that I did not know, who also lives here in Richmond, Indiana, the page was forwarded to her, and she looked at it, and it just kind of clicked in her head, this is exactly what I'm supposed to do. And so she contacted the hospital, and we were an excellent match, and that's the story. And everything is going fantastically well. It's been over a year now.
Well, that's fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I understand that now there is actually that same student has a Facebook page now to help connect other donors.
Yeah, she started the day of my transplant, which is kind of an interesting timing. She decided there's so many people in need that maybe she could develop a way to help advertise all these different pages that were trying to find a donor. And so it's Find a Kidney Central, which you can find on Facebook. And she's helped just dozens and dozens of people find donors through Facebook and social media. It's just an amazing story, and it's something that I'm honored just to be a little part of, that to think in any way Leah's inspiration came from helping me. That's just amazing to me.
Sam, tell us, how unusual is Jerry's story in terms of the way he found a kidney?
Well, anymore, it's not unusual at all. And to the extent that if you look at the current statistics, you had mentioned that there are more than 110,000 people waiting in the United States who need some sort of a solid organ transplant. The majority of the people on that list need a kidney. That's true for Indiana as well. And when I say a majority, I'm talking close to 80% or more that need a kidney. And kidney disease is prolific in the United States, and it's often an undetected, unknown circumstance because it in large measure is created by other disease processes that you're either not managing or you don't know you have. Diabetes and high blood pressure are two things that are just really hard on kidneys. And by the time you get to that experience of seeing the symptoms, then you can very well be in trouble. And then, of course, there is a large number of the people on the list who have a genetic defect that they don't know they have until the symptoms begin to manifest themselves. Or, interestingly, I just met a woman from southern Indiana who volunteered to donate a kidney to someone in her community, a young man in her community. She went through the testing process, and they discovered that she has a kidney disease herself that will prevent her from being a donor, but in the future years is likely to put her on the transplant waiting list.
Wow.
That's a little bit scary.
Well, it is. And one of the things, as Mr. Wild knows by talking to his physicians, is that pretty much if you are a patient who's told you're an end-stage renal failure, or you're headed that way, they're going to ask you if you know anybody you can approach, whether it's in your own family or any other social circles, your business circles, or the community at large, as he did and a lot of other people are doing, because that will generally be the fastest way for you to get the kidney that you need, either before you get on the list or if everything matches up and it's a directed gift, it gets your transplant a lot sooner.
How often are transplants done from live donors?
Well, before I came on the air, I was looking at some statistics, which you can find at UNOS.org. And I'll tell you more about that later if we have time. But back in 1988, when they started collecting data, and that's when the organ donation and transplant system really in the United States started to unfold, there were 1,800 living donor kidney transplants in the United States. So far, through the 26th of July in 2013, we've done a little over 1,800 already. And
that's
so
an amazing change.
It is an amazing change. And there was a point a few years ago where the number of living donor transplants equaled the number of deceased organ transplants. And so today, the most common living donor or transplant is a kidney. Livers have kind of fallen out of favor because there's high risk to the donor, less to the recipient, but kidneys are very common. And it's just because there's so many people waiting.
Jerry, we had hoped to have your doctor, Dr. William Goggins, on the phone from IU Health, but it turns out he's actually in the middle of a transplant surgery right now. But Jerry, can you tell us a little bit, how long had you been waiting at the point when the Facebook page turned up a donor for you, and did you ever expect that you would find one this way?
You know, it's one of those things that you always want to hope for the best, but I'm a very, very difficult person to match. I had a transplant for 17 years. I had a lot of antigens, antibodies that had built up in my blood. So even if a person was my blood type, there was less than a 9% chance that they would actually match me. So even though a lot of people had come forward and wanted to be a match, it was just very difficult to find somebody who was compatible with me. And actually, what's interesting is there were two people that previously had actually been a match, but the doctors and the process through the medical community, they are so protective of the donors that if there's any issues that might pose a risk for the donor, they just won't allow them to continue. And as was mentioned earlier, any kind of blood pressure issues, any kind of body mass index issues, things like that, they, even though the donor would probably go ahead with it, they, for their own good, their own protection, they won't allow that. So they're very protective of the donors.
Sam, can you talk a little bit about that? How do they choose who is an appropriate donor?
Well, when it comes to living donation, it's in many ways it's a little more complicated because, first of all, the surgeons want to be sure that a person who is stepping up to go through a significant medical procedure that provides absolutely no benefit for them, that they really understand all the implications. So there's the psychological and social workup that goes through. And then you do have to have an appropriate match. As you were talking about this and Jerry was explaining his circumstances, I was reminded of what is considered to be the first successful transplant in the United States. And it goes back to 1954, and it involved two twin brothers, identical twin brothers. And at that time, there was not as much science and knowledge behind immunosuppression and immunology. But when an identical twin gives a kidney to his identical twin, the body doesn't recognize it as anything other than, okay, I had surgery, but no big deal. So when it comes to siblings or children, it's not always a perfect match. And the objective of the surgeon in making a decision is, what will I see as an outcome long term for the patient receiving that organ if I choose this particular donor to match with this particular recipient? And as Jerry stated, when it comes to kidneys, there's a little more to it than just size or blood type. Kidneys are peculiar. There are six antigens, and the more of those antigens from donor to recipient that align themselves, the more likely it is that the long-term success of that transplant, which in our field of healthcare really is considered long-term success if you're 5 years out and the kidney is still functioning or the organ is still functioning, that's what they're looking for. Now, there have been many successful transplants from deceased donors and living donors where those antigens don't match one-to-one-to-one for all six. So I don't want to mislead anybody, but those are things that go into consideration when they're trying to decide, is this the right kidney, in this case, for the right recipient?
You mentioned that kidneys are the most common live donation situation and that livers have fallen out of favor a little bit. Are there other organs that can be transplanted from a live donor?
There have been a few instances where a lobe of the lung can be taken from a living donor and transplanted, but that generally is considered to be somewhat of a bridge to a different type of transplant where you can get a full transplant of lungs, because the liver is a unique organ in that you can separate it because there are two lobes, and you can take the smaller lobe and you can put it into an adult, and over time, in about 6 months, that liver will grow to be the size needed for that recipient. The problem is not for the recipient, it's more for the complications and the high morbidity that had developed for the donor. And frankly, so much has been learned about accepting a wider range of deceased donor organs, in particular livers, that can be successful long term, that it's most physicians, surgeons will say, I don't want to put a patient at risk for that when it's not needed.
What are the risks for a live donor who is donating a kidney?
Well, one of the reasons that the surgery itself or the procedure where you have a living patient willing to sacrifice a vital organ for somebody else is because of the surgery technique. The surgery I mentioned that took place in the 1950s, you know, that was a typical make a big incision into the abdomen and you go in and you hunt for the kidney, you take it out and you transplant it the same way. Well, today, laparoscopic surgery is absolutely common, and so that reduces a lot of the trauma of surgery to begin with. So there's about four little incisions, and there's a couple of scopes, there's a tool, and then they pump some inert gas into the abdominal cavity to expand it so the surgeons can see what they're doing. And to watch the surgery, they pull the kidney out through a little, you know, incision about the size of your index finger. And it's pretty remarkable. So that means that the recipient goes through less trauma. There's less chance of infections. There's less pain. And they can get back to a productive life pretty quickly. Whereas when you open the belly and you cut through muscle and all of the tissue, that's pretty dramatic surgery, regardless of what you're going in for. So that's a big help.
When someone goes in to be tested for a kidney transplant to see if they could be a donor for someone, do they then go on a list for other folks maybe that they don't know?
Well, that kind of depends. It was interesting in the case that I told you about the woman in southern Indiana who had agreed to be a donor for a young man in her community. Well, she found out that initially she wasn't a match for him, but if she was willing to donate her kidney into a small pool of potential recipients, then what that meant is somebody else who was willing to donate a kidney and was a match for the young man, it's a win-win. Now, this pool can get quite elaborate, and I believe the biggest paired donation exchange in the United States thus far has been something like 27 people. I mean, it's pretty remarkable, but a lot of things have to come together for that to work, but it can happen.
We'll come back to that. We're talking about organ donation on No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm Leslie Weidenbender, sitting in today for John Kroll. We're talking about organ donations with our guests. In the studio today, we have Sam Davis, Director of Public Affairs for the Indiana Organ Procurement Organization. And on the phone, we have Jerry Wild, a professor at Indiana University East in Richmond, who received a kidney transplant after one of his students found a donor on Facebook. Sam, we were talking before the break about how you can be tested to be a donor for one recipient, maybe someone you know or that you're related to, and end up being a possible donor for someone else that maybe you don't know. What are the issues that folks have to work through in those situations?
Well, donation, regardless of the type, whether it's a family honoring the decision of someone who has died, or making the decision for that loved one to be a donor, or an individual who agrees to go through the surgery and be a living donor. There are very personal implications for all of this. And I think when you look at the process, it would be very easy for me to agree right away to give an organ, a kidney to my children or my wife. That's pretty easy, emotionally anyway. I think, though, as I was telling you during the break, that the woman that I'm a professional colleague with down in southern Indiana who agreed to do this, she ended up being agreeable to go through a paired exchange. So she was not giving to the intended recipient that her family had bought into. And that's another thing that you have to consider when it comes to living donation, is that there are other people in your life who may question, why would you do this? Because they in turn could be fearful that something would happen to you and your other kidney. Now you're down to zero.
Yeah, that would certainly be a concern of mine.
That would be a concern. And, you know, the irony is, as Professor Wild knows, you can live a perfectly healthy and normal life with a single kidney. So nature did a good job of balancing that out, at least. But yeah, there are some considerations. And she told me, she said her family was a little concerned now. They're saying, okay, you just got us convinced to do it for this one person. Somebody in our community, we get that. We understand where your heart is. Now you're going to go and it's going to be different. And they work through that as well. But still, it's not always just cut and dried for everybody.
Jerry, we've been talking about some of the emotional issues here for a donor of a kidney. Of course, you went through the process of waiting for one. Can you tell us what the ups and downs were like in that regard?
Yeah, I certainly can. There's a lot of downs, and there's not many ups, quite honestly, because what a lot of people don't realize is the experience of dialysis is really designed to keep you alive. And you might look fairly normal, but you are very, very sick, and everything is hard. You constantly are thirsty because you have to watch what you drink. You have a very restricted diet of what you can eat. You just feel sick all the time. It always seems like there's some kind of problem in dialysis. There's a problem with the access point where they put the needles in, or there's an infection or something. So it's a very hard experience on the patient. And then, of course, I've had two situations where dear friends of mine have been matches, and you almost hate to get too excited because you know that something could go wrong, and both those times they did. So you try not to get too high, and you try not to get too low, and you just try to make it through each day and hope that, you know, every treatment goes fairly smoothly and you get in and you get out and you kind of live life as best you can during that very difficult time.
We've, of course, been speaking mostly so far about live organ donor transplants, but I think most people, when they think about organ donation, think about what will happen to them at the end of their life. What are the, you mentioned that kidneys are the most common organ that folks are waiting for. What comes next, and are there enough organs available for those folks?
Well, I'll start with the second question first. No, there are not enough organs available. And as Professor Wild is sharing his story, he's testament to that. If there were enough deceased organ donors, you would not have to be in pursuit of someone who goes through surgery that they get no benefit from, and the anxiety of waiting. Now, to the first part, kidneys are the most in demand, and after that, livers. Liver disease in the United States is also fairly common, and sometimes things affect the liver that a lot of people don't necessarily think about, and that can be some sort of an unknown virus. A number of our volunteers who have been successfully transplanted picked up a virus somewhere and it destroyed their heart or it destroyed their liver. There are certain toxins, there are genetic aspects, and yes, there is something known as fatty liver disease, and there's also hepatitis, which will destroy a liver over time. And thankfully, there's some good news on the horizon, particularly for hepatitis C, and probably within the next 5 years or so, you could see medical treatments that will eliminate the disastrous effects of hepatitis C. Hearts, of course, receive probably the most attention generally, and that goes back again in history to 1967 when Dr. Christian Bernard performed the first heart transplant in South Africa. And it really opened the window of possibility. And I think a lot of that was emotional because of how everybody perceives the heart as the center of life and the soul and all of that. So it's a little more glamorous, I think, probably for TV shows and movies to talk about heart transplants than liver and kidney or pancreas or small bowel or lungs or things like that. But regardless, if you're in need, if you're told one of your organs is failing and the last resort therapy is a transplant, that's pretty devastating news to hear.
It doesn't really matter which organ it is.
It doesn't really matter. And the list continues to grow. You know, during the time frame of the show here today, at least four people will be added to the transplant waiting list somewhere in the United States. And that happens every hour of every day. And at the same time, 18 to 20 people every 24 hours will die because they did not get the organ that they needed. And so the biggest challenge that we face in this field of healthcare is the number of viable organs. And it all begins with an individual making a decision to be an organ donor and registering that decision and then talking about it with your family so that they have an understanding of what's important to you while you're alive, because once you're gone, you can't make decisions anymore in the same way that you can when you're living. But that little red heart on your driver's license has a lot of power. It moves families to understand that this was important to you. So it generally will go forward and we can have a successful transplant.
I did want to talk to you specifically about that. Is the heart on your license, is that a contract? Does that hold meaning?
It does. It has legal implications in the state of Indiana and really most all states. And interestingly, it has since the 1960s. Indiana adopted what is known as the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act back in 1968. All 50 states have a Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. And at that time, it established that any person over the 18 could make a decision to be a donor. And they created an aspect of that decision-making with a legal document of gift. And so, yes, you could put it on your driver's license, or back in those days, we had donor cards. And they were not very practical because you kept them in your wallet or you kept them in the drawer at home. And we didn't have an accessible database the way we do today to look up the driving record. Well, all of that's been automated and put into computers, so it's much easier to access it. And in the and what the law stated even back in the 1960s when transplants were still very experimental was that if the hospital taking care of the patient had a document of gift, no other permission was needed. But rarely did the physicians, nurses, and administrators of the hospital have that at their disposal. So then the fallback was you go to the next of kin in a hierarchy and you ask for permission. And that process stayed pretty much the same for decades. And only recently has the shortage become so critical that most organizations in the United States, like mine, will move forward with a donation for a patient that has a document of gift that we can produce. And rarely does it create a problem for families. I mean, it's a struggle sometimes because of all that's going on. But at the same time, you know, we're supporting the right of the individual to make that decision. It was important to them. And we know that most Hoosiers agree that it's the right thing to do.
We have a question from a listener that came through Twitter, and it's: Do you foresee a time when organ donation becomes automatic, so that you actually have to opt out of donation rather than opting in?
That's a question that has been asked through the 15 years that I've worked in this field of healthcare, and in some countries in the world, that's exactly the way their system works. It is an opt out. We look at the cultural differences, though, and the practicalities of doing that. So obviously, if it is just presumed that I am a donor, once I hit 18 and I'm of legal age, that's just the automatic. It would increase the number of organs that could be available. That is true. Whether or not the public would accept that or not is another question. And I don't know that you can make a one-to-one comparison, say, well, if they do it in Spain, then we can do it here in the United States. I think it's something that needs to be talked about. Another aspect of producing more organs is paying donor families something to get them to agree. That is a conversation that's, again, has been going on for decades, and there's a lot of concern about it. The Indiana University School on Philanthropy did a study on health-related philanthropy, and their survey showed that most people surveyed agreed that donation was the right thing to do. But they did get uncomfortable with the aspect of a monetary exchange back and forth, because then it's not really a gift. You're sort of buying and selling or bartering, if you will. And that took away the humanity of it. And so that was kind of unsettling for the people that were surveyed.
I can understand that. I can imagine that would be pretty unsettling. Jerry, your story has received quite a lot of attention. I was wondering, do you feel like you have inspired folks, your story has inspired other folks to become organ donors?
You know, it's interesting you should mention that. I was getting my blood drawn a few months ago. And as you might expect, I'm pretty good friends with the lab technicians at the local hospital. I get my blood drawn pretty regularly. And one of the technicians kind of said, hey, I wanted to let you know that twice now I've had people come in and say, I'm being tested because of that guy's story. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, they couldn't remember your name, but they said that guy that's been on the news lately. And I decided I could maybe do something to help somebody. So, yeah, I do think, if nothing else, at least in our little local part of the world, and we've received some pretty interesting national attention, I think it, as long as people are starting to have a conversation and maybe around the dinner table at night, families discussing this, and maybe it raises awareness, and I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think the more we can kind of carry this message of how great the need is, that can only help.
Jerry, have you stayed in touch with the young woman who gave you a donation?
Oh, my. Yes. Both Becky and Leah, I genuinely think of them as two of my closest friends in the whole world. We're in touch all the time. We have a connection that is unlike any connection I have with anybody. And she's a very, very dear friend and probably one of the nicest people I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. You know, not only did she save my life, I have this incredibly dear friend that we can talk about anything with, and we're just very, very close. I talk to Becky almost every day. We correspond text or email or talk almost every day. And the same thing with Leah, the person that set up the Find a Kidney Central page. So that's just a hidden little bonus of this.
And what is Leah doing now?
Leah now is, she's the mother of three. She is a stay-at-home mom right now. She's very, very busy. And in fact, she sent her her middle child off to kindergarten today. So that was kind of a, I remember those days very well. And those are wonderful but traumatic times for parents too.
Sure. Well, we were talking about making sure and ensuring that if you want to be a donor, that you do become one. We talked about having the heart on your driver's license. Are there other ways that you can ensure that you will be a donor?
Well, in this computer age, of course, there's a website you can go to. It's donatelifeindiana.org. The process takes about 5 minutes, and it puts your information into the system, and only at the time of your near death or at your death will a hospital refer a potential patient who could be a potential donor to us, and we will look the information up. And at the appropriate time, we'll share that information with the family so that they know. Because, you know, as Jerry said, I love the dinner table conversation. Now, at my house, this is a no-brainer. I mean, the kids, we talk about it and when they were young, and, you know, I have an adult son now, and so we still have a conversation. But most families don't like to talk about death in the United States. It's just not a real popular topic, and end-of-life discussions are not easy. I think what is so rewarding for me still is that no matter what I tell people, whether it's radio or face-to-face about the facts and figures of donation, Professor Wild's story and other recipient stories and donor family stories, that trumps anything I can tell people because it's real life. You can hear the sincerity in his voice. You can hear the gratitude for the gift and the implications of what it meant to his donor. And that's honestly what donor families want to know. Did this gift help? And in what ways? Not just making somebody feel better, but are they back to work? Are they back to their hobbies? Are they back to playing with their grandkids, living life to the fullest? That's the legacy that I know from our donor families of deceased donors. That's what they want. And he talked about the friendships. Just recently, we met two women from the South Bend area. They were friends, sort of. They were acquaintance. They became living donor recipient for kidney. And everybody is doing well. And they formed a bond that is so unique. But it tells a remarkable story about humanity. And that trumps anything that I can tell people.
Do people who receive donations of organs from folks who've died, do they often know who their organs came from?
It's possible to do that. Both parties have to be open to that. And, you know, I like to think of a man that I met in our Fort Wayne office who came to a ceremony that we had. He was a very quiet gentleman, and he received a heart transplant. At the time, it would have been about 11 years prior to this event. And he hung back from the crowd, and he kept looking at me, and I finally went over and talked to him, and he could barely look me in the eye, and he said, "I received a heart transplant about 11 years ago, and I just could not bring myself to reach out. I didn't know what to say, and I'm feeling so guilty because I didn't." So he gave me some basic information, and I happened to know his surgeon, and I called her, and she knew him, and she knew that he was worried about this, and it was bothering him, and we tried to find his donor, and the trail ended, and I couldn't help. But I could see the anxiety, but yet I understood his piece of it was, this is hard. I know what had to happen for me to have a second chance at life and live for these 11 years. Somebody else lost a loved one. I don't always know what to say. Still, I know others who have come together and formed such wonderful friendships that they almost become blended families. And it's a remarkable thing to see.
Well, we're talking about organ donation and the questions and issues that surround it here on No Limits. You can join our conversation when we come back from the break. You can call us at 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org or connect via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please stay with us and come back after the break.
No Limits is made possible by your membership and by Junior Achievement, announcing Indy's Best and Brightest Awards, now accepting nominations for young professionals age 40 and under who are making an impact in the community. More at indiesbestandbrightest.org, and by Community Hospitals North and East, in collaboration with MD Anderson Cancer Network, a program of the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, dedicated to bringing a higher level of cancer care to Indiana. More at ecommunity.com/cancercare. And by Think About Your Eyes. More information available at thinkaboutyoureyes.com. To call into No Limits this afternoon, the toll-free number is 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. This is 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Mostly sunny skies for this afternoon, a high of 81.
Welcome back to No Limits. I'm Leslie Weidenbinner, sitting in for John Kroll. We're talking about organ donation with our guests in the studio, Sam Davis, Director of Public Affairs for the Indiana Organ Procurement Organization. And on the phone, we have Jerry Wild, a professor who received a kidney transplant after one of his students found a donor for him on a Facebook page. Jerry, I just wondered if you could talk a little bit or tell us what encouragement you give others about why they should become organ donors.
I think the simple message is what you can do with this incredible gift is you can take somebody who's very, very ill and you can make them well, and they will live largely a very normal life. I consider my life completely normal. I take more medicine than most people. That's really it. I do everything I want to do. I'm fully active. I run. I work out. I do everything that I want to do with my life. And actually, there is a risk anytime you go for a medical procedure. But in terms of long-term risk, what the research that I've been quoted by a number of doctors, and I'm sure your guests could back this up, that living donors actually have a slightly longer life expectancy than people who aren't donors. So the actual risk to the donors, while of course there is, are generally fairly minimal, and they make a recovery and they go on and live their lives completely normally. My donor I know has basically perfect kidney functioning with one kidney, and so do I. So it's a remarkable gift that you can save someone's life, and it's just got to be the most generous thing anybody can do.
They're obviously heart-wrenching decisions, whether this occurs during a live donation or an end-of-life donation. But I think there's a lot of confusion about when organs are recovered in those end-of-life situations. Sam, can you talk a little bit about when that occurs?
In the United States, and really in all developed countries, there is something known as the dead donor rule. And that is, organs are only recovered from people who have been pronounced dead by a physician. And that's absolutely essential to the trust that we work to instill in the public every day, every time we have a conversation about donation. It's important. And as I mentioned earlier, because death is an uncomfortable thing for us to talk about, end-of-life decisions, no matter what it is, we don't want to have those full-blown conversations because we never want to imagine that I'm going to have to be in a position to talk about something like this with one of my relatives, my family. And that's particularly true with children. Parents don't want to be in a position to outlive their kids. It's just not something that we want to go through. But regardless of the donation type, and when I say that, there are typically two ways that we will recover organs from a donor. One is when the patient has been pronounced brain dead. And there's a lot of testing that goes on, but the brain has been determined to have absolutely no function. And interestingly, we were talking about the heart being perceived as the center of life. It's really your brain, because it's telling everything else what to do and how to do it and when to do it. And when that stops, you can't breathe on your own. Your other hormonal systems stop working. You lose muscle tone and all kinds of things that are just it's not congruent with life. It's not a coma. There's a difference. And then we have people who are suffering such a severe brain injury that they won't be able to breathe on their own, and their families come to the conclusion, either independently of a decision made by the patient or the patient has said, if I ever get to this point, I don't want to have any life-sustaining mechanical ventilation and support just for that purpose. And so families do go through that conversation. That happens a lot in hospitals, even if the patient has no potential to be an organ or donor of any kind. They still have to come to grips with those decisions. So a lot of families will bring that up at the same time. They'll go to the nurse caring for their loved one, or they'll go to the doctor and say, okay, we need to talk about what's next. And we also want to talk about donation as we see what's possible. But generally in those circumstances where a person is still living, but they're working on a decision to do the end of life care, we want those two conversations to be separate. And that's at least from the medical professional side and from our side. Now, if families bring things up, we can't control what they're thinking and how they're presenting information or the needs that they have to help them make decisions. So sometimes that conversation is blended, but that's them blending it, not the other way around. One other thing that's tied to this is that one of the most pervasive misconceptions that we hear from the public is, well, if you guys know that I want to be a donor and something happens to me, you're not going to take care of me. You're going to give up too soon, and you're just not going to bother. And that could be that's just so not true. It's the farthest thing from the truth. And frankly, I think my colleagues who do this unique field of work across the United States, I don't think we would tolerate that. It isn't necessary, and just from the experience of working with so many professional nurses and intensive care unit professionals, trauma surgeons, et cetera, they do everything possible to save your life. Unfortunately, sometimes it just doesn't work out that way.
Well, we're fortunate we have Leah on the phone, actually, and Leah is the young woman who helped Jerry out when he was looking for a kidney to be transplanted. Hi, Leah. Thank you for joining us.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us about how you got involved in this and then what you're doing now with the Facebook page?
Yeah, sure. It all started when Jerry kind of posted a status update, just a general status update, that he needed help and was still, you know, in need of a kidney. And he asked people to share his status update. And so I did. And then I just got to thinking, you know, there has to be a better way to get his need out there. And so I told him he needed a page. And he said, well, I don't know how to do that. And I said, hold on a minute. And so I kind of whipped up the Find a Kidney for Jerry page and shared it with my friends. My friends shared it. Jerry's friends shared it. Once you share a page, the more likes you get. And it ended up being successful. Becky found it and, you know, became his donor. And the rest is history. So.
Now, you've gone on and created another page. Is that correct? Facebook page, Find a Kidney Central. Is that right?
Yes. The same day that Jerry and Becky were in surgery, I created Find a Kidney Central, which is another Facebook page, and it's a centralized place where those people who are in need of a kidney can come. I have instructions on how to start a page and how to start their own kidney campaign on Facebook to try to help find a donor. I also, it's also a place where potential donors, people who are considering living kidney donation, can come. And I have a list of, I think we're up to 315 people in need in 41 different states. And they all have pages. And so if a potential donor comes by, I talk with them about what blood types they are, what state they're located in, and I kind of direct them to the pages of the people that they might match.
Do you have any idea how many matches out there that maybe you've been able to help with?
That question is asked of me a lot, and
I'm sure it's almost
because,
impossible to tell.
You know, with people in 41 different states, everybody has their own lives. I don't really get you know, the full updates. I'll see when they get their kidneys, and I know several of them have found them on Facebook. But then, you know, there are others that have gotten deceased donor kidneys, and some that ended up having family members be a match. So I do not have that exact number, but I know that there have been several that have found their donors because of their Facebook pages.
Well, Leah, thank you so much for calling in. Tell us again what that Facebook page is so folks can check it out.
It's Find a Kidney Central, and if they just put it in, you know, the Facebook search, it should pop right up. Right there on Facebook, Find a Kidney Central.
Leah, thank you so much. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks so much.
We're going to go to back to Jerry a little bit to talk about how you encourage, do you encourage other folks to go to Facebook to check out that page?
Absolutely, because, you know, it's such an easy way to get the message out there. It's free. It literally can kind of become viral, and you can reach thousands and thousands of people in a very short period of time. And I think, you know, it's kind of this, the social media changes a lot of things about our lives. And I know people complain a lot about Facebook. It's kind of a waste of time. And I always go, wait a minute, it's not always a waste of time. And then I can tell them a little bit about my story. So, yeah, but I absolutely encourage people who are in a need, to use every mechanism you can to get your story out there.
We have actually a Facebook follower who has a question. Sam, he says his father is 72 years old and suffers from later stage kidney disease. He's a 38-year-old male and a regular runner, very conscious of his the quality of his food that he eats and of his health. He wants to know what steps can his family take ahead of time, physically, legally, etc., to prepare for a kidney donation should the need arise down the road. And what questions do they need to be talking to their doctors about now?
Well, I think certainly for a patient who is in their 70s, the physician caring for them and certainly the transplant nephrologist and surgeons are going to determine whether or not he could withstand the surgery. I mean, because surgery is hard no matter what your age, but certainly the older you get, there are different implications. So I would start having that conversation now. It is possible for older people to receive transplants. It's even possible for older people to be donors. So I would start those general conversations now with a transplant nephrologist. To see what would be the possibility. I think they're going to want to know the social and medical history background of the son, and they'll do all those things. Obviously, if you're keeping yourself in good health, that is a plus, absolutely, because the healthier you are, the likelihood that your kidneys and your other organs are healthy as well. And so that extends the benefit possibilities for your dad. So it's really just finding a transplant program from wherever you live that will sit down and have a conversation with all of you about what it's going to mean to go through this process. But I think the first thing they're going to want to look at is whether or not that your dad has the overall health qualities to go through a surgery.
We do have a caller, Steve, who has a question. Can you go ahead, Steve?
Yeah, my name's Steve, and I've been in the wonderful care of IU, but I no longer have the funds to commit to do it, and employers don't. I have to hide it from employers to keep a job or to get a job. What can a person do for funds when they have loved ones without losing everything?
Well, I know that the folks at IU Health have a lot of very smart people that should be able to walk you through a variety of programs, some of which, you know, you perhaps may not necessarily find appealing. But I know that one of the things that keeps people from believing that they can get a transplant is because of the financial implications. And generally, the financial counselors and social workers at a transplant program have a lot of resources that they can put you in touch with and help you work through that. I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying that the experiences that you you've been through aren't real and don't have real implications for your situation. Generally, we have found through what the transplant centers, whether it's IU or St. Vincent or Lutheran up in Fort Wayne, what they tell us so that we can help better educate the public is just simply talk to them and see what's possible. I know some patients have been able to get on the state paid for sort of kind of Medicaid, quasi-Medicaid system to help pay for that. There's also a very wonderful organization in Indiana called COTA, C-O-T-A. They're headquartered in Bloomington. That stands for the Children's Organ Transplant Association. They do not limit their help in fundraising to help pay for transplants and medicines and things like that to just children. I know the executive director there, Rick Lofgren. He's a wonderful guy, and I've known him for all of my career at Indiana Organ Procurement. And so I would consider even contacting them, because they help people nationwide connect with the resources that they need, including some fundraising that communities often put on to help people like you find the funds needed. And I wish you good luck on that.
So if a person wants, maybe a person doesn't know someone who needs, for instance, a kidney transplant, but just wants to look into it, where should that conversation start? Should it start with their own physician?
Well, that's a reasonable place to start. And I would say that not all family physicians may have the full scope and background. I think most physicians here in Indiana would be aware that Indiana University School of Medicine does kidney transplants, that St. Vincent Hospital in Indianapolis does them, and Lutheran Hospital in Fort Wayne does them. So that network of physicians and the outreach programs that all of those transplant centers have will probably mean that your primary care physician is going to have some knowledge. But eventually, it gets down to you making the call to the transplant center and saying, I'm interested in doing this. Can you give me more information? They're likely to invite you in. They'll send you some information so you can make an informed decision about it. And, if it looks like you could go forward, then you'll take the next steps. Will there be testing? Will you go through all of the regimen of the social history, the medical history, the psychological workup, et cetera?
And are there very many folks who just sort of decide out of the blue they think this is something they might want to do?
You know, I don't have statistics on what are known as Good Samaritan donors, which are people who just say, I'm willing to do this. Interestingly, many years ago, an employee that worked for me, and she was a nurse, she had seen at a conference the laparoscopic kidney nephrectomy procedure done, and it encouraged her right then and there that this is something that she believes she could tolerate, and she donated a kidney to a 13-year-old boy in Maryland. She happened to live in Fort Wayne, Indiana, when she worked for us. She used her healthcare background to help make that decision. But I don't know the statistics of how many are just Good Samaritan donors. I didn't look that up before I came.
Jerry, we've just got a few seconds left. What is your last message for folks about whether they should consider organ donation?
You know, I think it's the most amazing act of love that you can do for somebody. And Becky, my donor, had been asking God to find purpose for her, find purpose in her life. And she saw this Facebook post, and it just clicked in her head that this is exactly what I'm supposed to do. This man needs my help. I have two kidneys. He needs one. And so I would just encourage people to give it some thought, that it's a remarkable, it kind of restores people's faith in humanity, that they're truly incredibly generous people out there, and it's good to know that. I think that's why this story has touched a lot of people.
Thank you so much, Jerry.
That's been
Jerry Wild, who received a transplant. We also have been with Sam Davis, Director of Public Affairs for the Indiana Organ Procurement Organization. Thanks for joining us, Sam.
Thank you.
Join us next week when John Kroll will be back hosting No Limits. Come back and see us soon.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.